When Black women are affected by the trauma of policing, either by witnessing, in the case of Diamond Reynolds and her young daughter, Philando Castile's girlfriend and her young daughter who was in the car when he was shot and killed, how is it possible that we would think about that as secondary trauma? As far as I'm concerned, that's a primary trauma.
This is part two of our conversation with Dr. Kristen Smith, professor of African and Diaspora Studies and Anthropology at the University of Texas at Austin. We highly encourage you to listen to part one about the effect of police violence on Black women's health to get a bit more of the context for this conversation. In any case, we hope that you enjoy it. Here in Austin, racially charged police incidents are a big part of the story for Black residents on what life here is like.
Mm-hmm.
The death of Sophia King at the hands of Austin police officers back in 2002 sparked a conversation that ultimately led to things like the African American Quality of Life Initiative that we had here some years later. So as a newcomer to Austin, what has your work helped you to make sense of in living here?
Wow, that's a big question. I think that part of the biggest challenge I've had in living in Austin has been the way that the city continues to neglect its Black population.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be really honest with you. I feel like Austin is a powder keg. I feel like we are on the precipice of tragedy.
Yeah.
Because of the way that the city neglects its Black population, because of the kind of structured racism, structured anti-Blackness in particular, that Austin proliferates through not only culturally, but also politically, in the way that Black folk are erased, Black communities are erased in terms of enfranchisement, Black communities are erased in terms of our ability to have a voice. If we are not very careful here in Austin, we could see a Ferguson-style tragedy.
Right.
That is what I firmly believe. I live in East Austin. I live in Northeast Austin. And I'm in a community that I've often come home to police blocking my street, to helicopters hovering, to standoffs. I've often come home to young Black folk in my driveway being frisked and questioned. We need to be very careful here in Austin because our purported liberal identity does not take into account our deep-seated racism.
Yeah. So, and you know, I enjoy living in Austin. I wasn't born here, but I've lived here for most of my life. Think of it as my home. But then my relationship with my city is long and complicated, as I think tends to be the case. You know, for most Black folks who've lived here,
yes,
for as long as I have. And I don't know that there are very many like me who are like under the age of 50, which is always an interesting spot to be in. And, you know, people here are earnest and well-intentioned by and large when it comes to race. But that only makes the occasional tone deafness stand out that much more starkly. And any quality of life indicator that you want, whether it's policing, housing, education, employment, I mean, to me, it just all adds up to more stress, and that's at least, and that's if you have the luxury of approaching most of these issues most of the time as an abstract puzzle.
Yes, absolutely.
Until something happens that you no longer can afford that distance. And so, I'm sure my heart wishes that I would stop putting it into this conversation, you know, because talk about tempting fate. But I wonder about all the extra heartbeats that I'm going to lose at the end of my days because of the time I spend worrying about the cops around here.
Yeah.
Just to give one example, or a more mundane example. So, I mean, Austin has a very lively craft beer scene. And like all things Austin, you know, you're at first tantalized by, you know, the possibilities of new experiences, meeting new people, new flavors, you know, new ways to get that warm and cozy feeling that beer can give you. But also at the same time, you're mindful of the opportunities for new stresses, new misunderstandings, new ways of having it brought home to you just how much you don't fit in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And but that won't stop you from, you know, soaking up, you know, what there is to be soaked up from all the different things that a city like this has to offer,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I think I absolutely agree with you. There are things that I love about Austin. I love the outdoors. I love the lake.
Yeah.
I love the fact that there's so many playgrounds and things. I have two small kids.
Yeah.
And so I love the fact that it's such an outdoors city. It's such an informal city, etc. But I think that what many people in the city don't understand is the way that Black people who live in the city aren't necessarily allowed to enjoy the city in the same ways. And so, you know, every time my husband and I, for example, go out to a music festival that is an open air music festival, and we're there and we're having fun, and inevitably somebody comes and does some sort of racial microaggression that kind of ruins the day, you know? And I think that for many of us who are Black who live in Austin, we've come to just kind of accept that somebody's going to say something offensive to you every time you go out. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to do something to make you feel uncomfortable and unwanted.
Right.
Somebody who is going to somehow slight you and reduce the happiness that you can experience as an Austinite. And that hurts. And I think that, you know, if there's one thing that I hope that I can share with folk in Austin, is that as a black woman who's got a Black family, it's hurtful. It's hurtful when we walk outside and our new neighbors, ripe with gentrification, don't speak.
Yeah.
It's hurtful. It's hurtful when you go to music festivals and people kind of look at your husband like he's going to steal something. It's hurtful. It's hurtful. And it really makes people uncomfortable. It makes us paranoid. It makes us defensive, and it reduces our chances to be able to make friends. And I think that that's something that nobody wants to have to deal with. And I think that, unfortunately, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, I don't think that's the case, that, you know, I know a lot of Black people who don't have that experience. I think that there are a mm-hmm. lot of Black people in this city who just have given up saying how they feel. Because they've been hurt so many times by their friends and by people who they don't know.
Yeah. I spend a fair amount of time, getting back to beer culture, who knew that we'd spend this much time on that?
It's a great metaphor. It's fine.
I spend a fair amount of time in places like, you know, like pubs.
Mm-hmm.
And white people say all kinds of things to me, mm-hmm. you know? And that's part of, you know, what I appreciate about that culture, you know, mm-hmm. but, you know, people are more relaxed, you know, they've kind of got their barriers down, but I don't know what it is. Do I give off the sense that I'm undercover or something, or that I'm the one that they can talk to?
I don't know. I find that particularly white folk in Austin.
Yeah.
Particularly feel the desire to come out and talk to Black people when we are one of the few in the room.
Yeah.
And I think that in general, folk believe that they're being well-meaning. I think that they're trying to make you feel comfortable or trying to make you to let you know that they see you and they acknowledge you and all those kinds of things. But sometimes, to be perfectly honest, at the end of the day, you just kind of feel awkward and you feel very much, you know, put upon by those kinds of moments. And I think it's difficult. And you mentioned pubs. You know, when I was single here in Austin, I have horror stories of particularly, you know, white men coming up to me and wanting to talk to me or wanting to start a conversation with me and then me not being interested, which is my right, right? And then them saying things like, I remember this. It was right after President Barack Obama was elected, and I was at this bar and I was talking to some people, and these guys came up to me and my friend and said, you know, trying to see if they could, you know, start a conversation and show interest in us. And I was, you know, we kind of were just kind of like, oh, no, not really interested. Thank you. Have a great day. And I remember a belligerent response was, well, but I voted for Barack Obama.
Oh, yeah.
And that to me really encapsulated a lot of the experiences I've had in Austin. It's as if you don't necessarily want that friendship, or you don't necessarily want that relationship, or you don't necessarily want that conversation at that moment, then you then become the problem, and you then become you get attacked for that. And so there's this weird dynamic that happens where people are very open and welcoming, but if you don't necessarily want that, then folk can get really resentful and pretty mean sometimes, and that's also difficult to deal with.
Yeah. So as a foundation, we are trying to achieve a level of sophistication when it comes to enjoining people to the kinds of difficult conversations that we hope will give people tools for navigating the awkwardness that you describe. And of course, one of the bedrock principles is that you assume good intentions on the part of whoever it is that you're enjoining. As a person who uses words for a living, I am of many minds when it comes to dialogue, because maybe just because, you know, it can go so many different ways. And I think that the way that we customarily talk about it kind of strips it of a lot of its explosive potential.
Mm-hmm.
And on this issue, you know, how do we move the conversation forward? You know, sometimes you just want to shut down. You're not in the mood, just like you described.
Mm-hmm.
But without going numb or becoming cynical.
Well, I think the first step is to realize that the burden for doing the enjoining is not always on the Black person in the conversation.
Right.
I think to me, that's really the issue. It's not dialogue. It's not necessarily, it's not that folk aren't open to dialogue. It's that it's always perceived to be my burden to create a space to make the other person comfortable, and never the other way around. And so in these kinds of conversations, in these moments, folk want me to make them feel better. But I rarely, if ever, feel somebody trying to make me feel better. And so I think that one of the principles of dialogue that's absolutely fundamental is really trying to understand and think about the other person in the conversation. And I think that part of the challenge is that tends to be one-sided. And if there's one thing that people can do to really kind of rectify that is to also pause and say, okay, I'm feeling this way. I'm feeling like this person is shutting me down. But let me stop and think, well, why might that be happening? What might they be feeling? In what ways can I alter my behavior to make sure that that person feels a little bit more comfortable? Why are they feeling threatened by whatever it is that I'm doing? And I think it's a two-way street, right? And to me that's really something that we need to work on as a community, because it is a very, very one-way, one-sided conversation, you know? And I feel that acutely as a Black woman. When I'm around folk, that everybody wants me to make them feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
And nobody really makes gestures to making me feel more comfortable.
Right. So, I mean, and like I said, I'm of many minds on this. And one of those many minds is suspicious. I mean, I'm all for any tools or approaches that make these difficult conversations less difficult.
Mm-hmm.
For those who are willing to give their all to the process.
Absolutely.
And for those tools that exist, we ought to use them well. But, I mean, the most honest of these also make it clear that there are all kinds of reasons why conversations stall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, one party or the other might not be ready to have that conversation,
mm-hmm.
or to have it in good faith,
mm-hmm.
or to, you know, to check their own assumptions at the door.
Mm-hmm.
Or again, they have maybe an unrealistic expectation of a certain level of tranquility that mm-hmm. that they're hoping might be the norm during the conversation.
Absolutely. There's something that you just mentioned, and I think when we talk about dialogue, particularly in these kinds of conversations, yeah. right? One of the things that we constantly forget, and it's something that I'm working on. This is definitely one of my, you know, we all have our kind of personal goals in yeah. terms of interpersonal relationships.
Right.
And one of the things that I am constantly trying to remind myself of and am constantly trying to police myself on is the fact that we have to respect each other's silence. And
right.
we also have to, so dialogue is not just about talking. It's also about silence.
Right.
And it's also about listening. And I think that that's something that we have to start doing more of.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just as guilty, you know, especially when I think I know what's going to come out of someone's mouth.
Absolutely.
I get really impatient with listening to them.
Absolutely.
And I already know what my response is going to be. And I want to get to that point, you know, immediately.
Absolutely.
And I think there's tremendous value in checking one's impulse toward doing that.
Absolutely. And I think to me, you know, at the heart of the various conversations that you're invoking, that folk are trying to promote here, at the heart of it, I think there's that as well.
Yeah.
Right? It's like if you really want to engage in a process of enjoining, right, then part of that means knowing how and when to be quiet too
yeah.
and listen and to receive somebody's message as opposed to constantly broadcasting your own message.
Right. So we're accustomed to the idea of Black women, mothers, daughters, sisters, as collateral damage of the things that happen to Black men. But the intervention you're wanting to make, as much as anything else, is that this is a thing happening to Black women.
Yes.
Can you say some more on that?
Well, I think that one of the things that we tend to do when we talk about state violence is that we tend to think about it in a quantitative way.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to really rely on body count at the moment that in order to try to figure out, well, who are the victims in this equation? And what I really want to do is kind of disrupt that traditional approach and really say, no, when Black women are experiencing trauma because of police violence in particular, then we are the victims. We're the direct victims. We're not the secondary victims, if we're all familiar with the psychological terminology. We're not the secondary victims. We are the primary victims. And that can come in various iterations, but to think of us as collateral, to think of us as after effects for yeah. all intents and purposes, really doesn't pay attention to the very acute and primary forms of trauma that we carry on our bodies because of these experiences. And so I think particularly not only of the women who are the Black women who are the family members and relatives and loved ones of people who have been killed. And that can be any gender, right? And so it's not just the loved ones of men, but it's the loved ones of anyone, right? Because part of what we need to do is kind of disrupt this notion that it's only Black men that are getting killed by the police in terms of physical killing. There's also a lot of physical aggression that's happening with Black women as well. And I think, you know, here in Austin, we can't ignore the case of Breonna King. Right. And so Breonna King was the school teacher who mm-hmm. was body slammed by an Austin police officer,
yeah.
Producing all kinds of trauma and then subjected to a very demeaning, racially charged conversation in the back of his cruiser yeah. on the way to booking. Nobody should have to deal with that kind of stuff. And so there are ways that there are legible ways that police violence also directly affects Black women. But in addition to that, part of what I really want to push forward as a conversation is that when Black women are affected by the trauma of policing, either by witnessing in the case of Diamond Reynolds and her young daughter, Philando Castile's girlfriend and her young daughter who was in the car when he was shot and killed. How is it possible that we would think about that as secondary trauma? As far as I'm concerned, that's a primary trauma. When you are forced to watch somebody get shot and killed and you can't do anything about it, you're dragged out of the car and handcuffed while your daughter is screaming and trying to console you because you are inconsolable because you just watched a loved one die, but you want to call that secondary and collateral trauma? I think we must rethink that. And I think that part of the problem is we tend to think about violence in masculinist ways. What do I mean by that? We tend to think about violence as only that which physically affects the body in the moment that we can see. And so if somebody's not getting hit, if somebody's not getting shot, then we don't think that it's a violent thing. But as far as I'm concerned, the kind of violence that Diamond Reynolds was subjected to in that police cruiser and in the car when she watched her boyfriend get shot and killed, that is a direct form of violence. It's not just secondary trauma. So that's what I mean by that.
Yeah. I'm used to people saying, I have a mother or I have a daughter, usually in reaction to the trouble that men cause or the trouble that men get into. I mean, let's be honest. And my mom raised four sons to manhood, which, you know, and that's a rhetorical card I play sometimes. Or when I say that to people, I'm used to them go, oh, wow. It's a hollow kind of of respect, if you ask me. But going off what you said, or if you're trying to get a black man not to do something, invoke his mom. What would your mother think? am I the only one who's ever noticed that? It's often effective, which kind of underscores my point here. But I want to say that, you know, where the conversation I think needs to go is toward a recentering of black women as being rightfully half of where our analytic focus should be.
Exactly.
And not just symbols that we invoke for sentimental reasons.
Exactly. Yeah. And not afterthoughts to our research.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that part of the reason why we envision victimhood in narratives of police violence to be masculine is because our research methodologies are masculinized. The way that we approach thinking about it, I love the way that you put that. The way that we approach thinking about it supposes that women are disproportionately unaffected by it, not factoring in that if we're 50% of the population, chances are we are 50% of what's going on in whatever equation that we're looking at. Yeah. And so we have to shift our analytics in order to really understand, well, what if you're coming out with statistics that say that 95% of the people involved in this particular phenomenon are men, then chances are you need to stop, take a step back and say, what am I missing here? Because you have to be missing something. There's not a gender skew in that direction to that extreme without you missing some component of what's going on. And so part of what my work really does is really take that step back. And the way that I've tried to kind of shift our thinking is say the problem is the way that we're approaching this according to time. We're thinking about police violence as a discrete moment in time that with a beginning and an ending. The beginning, Eric Garner was stopped by a police officer on a corner at 3:30 p.m. on July 17th, 2013, right? So when you look at that, and I think it's July 17th, hopefully I have the right date. When you look at that, it's as if that story of that police encounter starts at that moment. But if you look at the transcript of the video and you listen to what he says, why are y'all harassing me? Why do y'all keep doing this to me?
Right.
Meaning the story didn't begin there.
Right.
And so if we think about time in a different way, then none of these stories are beginning and ending where you think that they do. In which case, part of the reason why we don't see black women as victims of police violence is because we have a very different perception of time that doesn't really account for the expansiveness of the event.
Yeah.
And so that to me means it's shifting our analytics, shifting the way that we approach things.
Right. And aside from everything else, and thank you for that, because it really gets at, I think one of the critical components of what we like to call the social determinants,
mm-hmm.
This temporal dimension that mm-hmm. it has,
mm-hmm.
But something that is it's like, you know, as much as it may be convenient for us when doing analyses, to focus on kind of discrete,
yes.
either discrete events. Or to kind of section things into relatively, cut and dried, stop and start points. That's not how things are experienced.
Absolutely.
So aside from everything else, I have one more reason to be jealous of you.
How's it possible? Jealousy, no.
How's it possible? You need to know me. But you just wrote a book titled Afro Paradise, Blackness, Violence, and Performance in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's no other way that I can be helpful, it's putting a focus on women and their work.
So thank you.
So how did it come together, and what are you trying to say in it?
Well, that's an interesting story. So it's a book about my work with communities in Salvador, Bahia, Brazil, around police violence, actually.
Yeah.
And the project started back in 2003 when I first traveled to Bahia to do work with a theater group there that was doing work in the community. And ironically enough, the play that they were working on was a play that focused on Black people's experiences with racism. In Salvador, and a good portion of that play focused on police raids and police violence. Because just like here in the United States, police violence against Black people is an acute problem in Brazil. You have about 1,000 people that are killed by the police in the United States each year. About 1,000 people were killed by the police in Rio de Janeiro in the first month of this year. And so that just goes to show you in terms of skew and scale. And so this particular book is really an exploration of this painful issue from the perspective of the Black community. Because I think a lot of times these kinds of conversations, particularly around policing, are had from a research perspective that's an outside perspective. And I really mm-hmm. wanted to get people's stories. And so I was in Bahia for several years, and I interviewed people and I talked to people about their stories around police violence. And I worked with this particular theater group that was working on this play about it. And I started to really excavate the experiences that the Black community is having there and their responses to it. And so the book really focuses on that. And interestingly enough, the book ends where this project on the impact of police violence on Black women begins, right? And so I end by really talking about how police violence is something that affects the entire family. It's not just one person that's impacted by it. And it's really my experiences in Brazil, learning from people in communities about how they're theorizing and thinking about their experiences with police violence, that taught me to think in this way. And so I always try to give them the credit. This is a community grassroots theoretical perspective that comes from my experience with activism.
Okay. So she is Dr. Kristen Smith. Her book, Afro Paradise, Blackness, Violence, and Performance in Brazil. We are talking about police violence as a thing that happens to individuals, as something that communities struggle with, as something that everyone struggles to talk about, mm-hmm. and as a condition of the African diaspora in the Western Hemisphere. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this fairly expansive dialogue on something that may not be that much easier to talk about for all the minutes, that one might spend in trying. But hopefully people will take this as an honest effort.
So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I really want to thank you and the Hogg Foundation for the invitation. I think it's so important to have these kinds of conversations, and I really appreciate you creating the space to be able to have this dialogue.
And this does it for this episode of the podcast. If you haven't done so recently, you should check out the Hogg Foundation website, hogg.utexas.edu. As ever, please leave a positive review for us on iTunes or make suggestions for future content and sign up for the Into the Fold e-newsletter. Thank you so much for joining us.